Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein. I've got a responsible day for you. It's the 20th of Adar Sheni, which means this is way after I was taping them because I'm finishing them in a year when there is no Adar Sheni. But you'll hear them, and God willing, you'll enjoy them, and maybe you'll write me, and I'll remember that I once upon a time did a project that I was happy with called A Responsible Day. Thank you to the OU, Rabbi Jacob Brown, and David Hochhauser for placing the issue online and available to you. And today we're going to see the wildest case, not the wildest, but one of the wildest cases that we've seen in many a year. And of course, as is so often true in Judaism, these are cases about marriage. Because one of the points that's come out of this series for me is a recognition of how much of their responsive time rabbis spend on marriage issues. Now, I don't know that you'd note it from just reading through books of their response, although I feel like just from the things that I've noticed, if you look at Rashi Pasuk Frank's Tshuvot, so many of them are about issues of marriage and divorce and how to write it get and how to know whose husband has passed away, who's not passed away. These are complicated issues that come up again and again, and they take up the time of our great Torah scholars, and they shape who they become. Meaning, if you're a Torah scholar, and let's say you know really all of Torah at a young age, and you're going to build on that and grow with that over the course of your life, and then it happens to be that you're put into a situation where an important need arrives, where you spend 70% of your time on one set of kinds of tshuvot, that's going to shape who you become as a Torah scholar. So it's a worthwhile thing to remember how much of these things about marriage. So in Igros Moshe, and Moshe Feinstein was obviously a tremendous giant who was comfortable and dealt with the breadth of Torah. Here's an example of where a marriage issue comes up. This is Shoot Igrot Moshe, Evan Ha'ezer Chelek Al, Simon Peitet, Responsum 89. And the discussion is about where the man says that they married, that he and this woman got married. The woman says they didn't. She doesn't just say they didn't, though. She says that the man brought a different woman before the rabbi, told the rabbi this was this woman's, whoever she is. We're going to get to that in a second. And so she's claiming, the rabbi will tell you there was a marriage, but it wasn't me, even though it was my name that was attached to the marriage. And so then the question also becomes, when there's a set of facts on the grounds that have been established, what situations allow for people, for participants in a certain set of actions, to claim that those actions don't look like they seem to have looked? And that's called an amatla, when they give some kind of an excuse or an explanation for why the set of events that occurred doesn't have the usual meaning that it would have in halakha. So this is a tshuva dated the 20th of Adar Sheni. That's our responsible day for today, 20th of Adar Sheni. This is from Tuf Shin Yud Aleph from 1951. So since the next Adar Sheni is in the year, the non-Jewish year 2019, Tuf Shin Ayin Tet, it will have been 68 years earlier than this will have occurred, 68 years before you'll be hearing it on the 20th of Adar Sheni. He's writing to a group of rabbis, the Vad HaRabbanim, meaning not just a group of rabbis, the committee of rabbis, the leading rabbis of Montreal at the time, one of whom was Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung, Alav HaShalom, at the time, who, when I didn't know him, but when I sort of met him, as it were, in the late 80s, early 90s, I think I saw him at a wedding in Montreal that I went to, must have been the late 80s, he was already a very, very old man. So this is 30 years before that. He's, a middle-aged man, and he's part of the Vada Rabbanim. And he wishes them, among other things, let's always remember that I don't review the honorifics and the good wishes that come at the beginning and end of responsa, but among these other things, he wishes them a Chag Kasher V'Sameach. So Chag Kasher V'Sameach is clearly referring to Pesach. So in Moshe Feinstein's mind, 20th of Adar Sheni, it's 3 weeks of Pesach, or more, it's more than 3 weeks till Pesach, it's time to already start wishing people a Chag Kasher V'Sameach. So now, here's the woman who's telling them that she was 15 years old when these events occurred. And they wanted to get married, and we're going to find out in the response, they want to get married because she's pregnant. So in 1951, to be pregnant is a terrible embarrassment to her family, whatever. So she thinks she has to get married. So she wants to get married, but, and they fled, it seems like they were in Montreal, but they fled to Toronto, or they went to Toronto to get married. But the city hall in Toronto wouldn't let her get married because she was only 15. She was underage. So I think in those situations, you were supposed to have been able to get your parents to come. I don't know why they didn't want the parents to come, but they didn't do that. Instead, her claim is that he found another woman, and he took this other woman down to City Hall. She was 22. He took her down to City Hall, and they wrote a license, a marriage license, for the name of the younger woman. Now, when I went to get a marriage license, which is a long time ago also, not 1951, but it's a while ago, you had to give identification to show that you were who you were. However they got around that, or however she thinks they got around that, that's her claim. Her claim is they never got married at City Hall. This man, the man in the picture, the father of her child, found another woman who was of age, married her to City Hall, but under the name of this pregnant 15-year-old. And he also, she says, he also went with this same 22-year-old to a certain Rav in Toronto, and the Rav did a marriage. He had a kiddushin and a chuppah. He did the whole thing, and he wrote a ketubah, and he did it all. They had told the Rav her name was the name of this 15-year-old. So that's her claim. Her claim is that this man set up a whole fake marriage, fooled everybody. How he got license documents for this or whatever, I don't know. But he, although it is the time before instant photographs, maybe you didn't need photo ID at the time, I'm not sure. But he convinced, this is the claim, he convinced the Rav, and it's not an obviously ridiculous claim because we're entertaining it now with Tshuva, convinced the Rav that this girl, that this woman was really this girl, convinced City Hall that this woman was really this girl, and now he has evidence that they're married. And she says they were never married. So what do you do? Now, the father of the child denies it. He says, no, they got married, and he thinks they're married. So they went and they checked with the Rav who did this kiddushin. And the Rav who did the marriage in Toronto seems to ratify what she said, because he wrote them, he wrote this Vada Rabbanim in Montreal, that the woman that he married to this young man had red hair. And then this girl that we have in front of us, who was the 15-year-old at the time the events occurred, she's got black hair. And then the Vada Rabbanim in Montreal realized that maybe women sometimes can dye their hair. So they went to, and this is going to be an interesting sort of side note in the tshuva, it's not really directly so directly related, but they went to experts in hair coloring who were able to say that, or to verify, that this young woman had never dyed her hair red, meaning if she had dyed her hair red, there would be evidence of it, whatever the evidence would be. They verified that she never dyed her hair red. So that seems to support her story. The Rav says, the woman that I married to this guy had red hair. She's never had red hair. And then, in addition, aside from that, they sent this young woman, the 15-year-old, to the Rav in Toronto. They paid for a trip, I guess. And he went, and the Rav and his wife looked at her, and they said, nope, this is not the girl. We've never seen this girl before. The Rav and his wife, and it's called Tviyut Ayin. Tviyut Ayin Halacha is an interesting category that we're going to get into a little bit. But Tviyut Ayin means, what if you can't give? So we all talk often about simanim, about identifying marks or characteristics on an object, let's say for lost objects, or on people. The other place where, in the very reverse of marriage, the other place where it comes up is, let's say, God forbid, somebody disappears, and then you find a corpse, somebody who's passed away. What are the ways that you can be sure that this corpse that you have in front of you is the person that you were looking for? And so Tviyut Ayin is a concept that comes up. Tviyut Ayin means that I recognize somebody. It's actually a remarkable thing. I've been noticing it lately because I don't feel like I look all that much like I looked when I was younger. I think there are many things, changes that have occurred. But yet sometimes I'll meet people who haven't seen me in 30 years, really 30 years. And it's embarrassing to me and upsetting to me that I can say those words out loud. There was a time when I couldn't say anything happened 30 years ago. But the people who really haven't seen me in 30 years or 25 years, and they recognize me. Now, I'm not great at that. So I do it occasionally. I'm really not great at that. But that's what Tviyut Ayin is. Tviyut Ayin is, I can't even tell you why I'm recognizing you. I can't, it's not that I can point out, oh, because you have a huge scar that runs from your left eyebrow down to the bottom of your neck from when you went into a sword fight with someone. That's a siman. That's not a Tviyut Ayin. Tviyut Ayin is, you just recognize. So the Rav and his wife say, we never saw this girl before. They have no Tviyut Ayin on her. They say they've never met her before. And they're clear that the woman that they married to this man is somebody else. And then in the letter from the Rabbanim in Montreal, there's this odd note that Ramosha's going to have to deal with, that they say, the girl says, the young said that when she got back from Toronto, meaning apparently she went with Toronto to him, apparently with intent to get married, and then her claim is, yeah, but when we got there, City Hall wouldn't take us, so the guy came up with this idea, and he did this whole trick with this other woman. So when she got back from Toronto, she went into a certain rabbi to get a friend of the family to get advice, because she's pregnant, and she tells the rabbi, the boy won't marry her, or didn't marry her. Now, I'm not sure what that means based on the previous story, where it sounds like he's doing everything he can to pretend that they're married, but the rabbi who she went into says, not only did she say he's not going to marry her, but she also referred to him as her husband. Now, referred to him as a husband sounds like he is married to her. So it might be that she meant he's not going to like live with her or support her or stuff like that, but she did refer to him as her husband. So she referred to him as her husband. That sounds like she had told this rabbi at the time, before an issue came up, that they were married. Now, that's a problem, because if a woman has at some point said she's married to a guy, it's much harder for her to later claim that they never were married. So that'll be a to part of the discussion. But Rosh Feinstein knows the immediate contradiction. How could she say both that he's not married to her, that he refuses to marry her, and that he's her husband? The letter also mentions nobody knows that they ever lived together in a house together. He always lived with his parents, she lived with her parents, and therefore, that's the question. We have all this conflicting evidence. We're going to see, it doesn't come up right now, but we're going to see later on in the responsum, Ramosha is going to mention that there are people who said that while they never lived together in their own apartment, there have been plenty of times when they've been alone together for extended periods of time. We have to assume that they were sort of living together. You know, they took, let's say, a weekend together would be an example of it. Let's say we all know they went to the country together on a holiday weekend and they stayed in the same room. That's going to come up as well after these events occurred. So, Moshe Feinstein points out that a Gemara in Kiddushin on Daf Samach Hei makes very clear that if a man says to a woman, I married you, and she says, no, you didn't, that we don't assume that they're married. She'ina ne'eseret, and that's Paskin Shulchan Aruch, in Evan Ezer, Siman Memket, and all the Poskim agree to it. And he says not only that, that the Halacha goes so far as to say that once that interaction occurs, even if he goes, let's say, and marries some of her relatives. Now, from his perspective, he's not allowed to do that. Why not? Because he said in court, I married you. So in halacha, there are certain relatives of hers he can never marry if he's married her. Let's say her sister during her lifetime, or her mother, right? Or her daughter. So this girl's 15. She doesn't have a daughter yet who's marriageable age. So let's say her mother. Let's say her mother's, you know, good looking, whatever it is, and he decides what they get. But whatever the answer, the way that it comes about is, normally, he's not allowed to do it. Now, if he does it, you might think, well, then we have to worry that maybe, in fact, he'd been married to the daughter, as he said he was, and then maybe, in fact, once he has relations with the mother, that mother becomes a psula lekahuna as a zona. Remember that halacha in the Torah is that a zona can't marry a kohen, and a zona doesn't mean in that context a prostitute. Zona is a word in Hebrew that means lots and lots of things in different contexts. A zona there doesn't mean a prostitute. A zona there means a woman who's had relations with a man who's prohibited to her by Torah law at a karet or a death penalty level. So the mother of the daughter, I think, is an example of that. So let's say he has a sister, certainly an example of that. So let's say he goes off, he has a relationship with the sister. Now, the sister can't say, you never married my sister, because she has no idea. So she can't be makheshet him. She can't deny his claim. And you might have thought, therefore, that she can no longer marry a kohen after that, because we have to worry that she's a zonah. But that's not the halacha. By virtue of the denial of the first woman, of the putative wife, the woman that this man said, kidashtich, that I married you to, and she said, no, you didn't, that denial is not only good enough for her, that denial is good enough for all of her relatives, that if something happens with this man afterwards, that in no way creates a psul lekuhuna, that doesn't create an invalidity for their ability to marry a kohen. So here Moshe Feinstein says that here we know that she didn't. Not only did she say that they never got married, but she has good evidence because the sign that she gave that she didn't have red hair had been verified, and had been verified by the people whose profession it is to see into hair coloring. Then Moshe Feinstein throws in a parenthetical comment that I found interesting, just because he then, the next line, sort of understands the response to his comment, but doesn't seem to notice it. I'm surprised at you that you had to go ask experts in hair coloring. Why you didn't just ask those who know her well, who could tell you, we've seen every day of her life, she's never had red hair. So he seems to say that he would have preferred that, or he doesn't think they wasted their time, but he seems to say he would have almost preferred that, because they're around her all the time. Then he says, but although I guess you have to worry that maybe she got her hair colored in Toronto. And so they would never know, and then I guess she would have waited in Toronto till it grew out, but that would be hard. She doesn't say that, but he also says, but I don't see why, because in Toronto, nobody knows her, so why would she have to dye her hair red? She says, I don't understand the whole thing. So in any case, complicated question, we don't have to get into it now, but that might be a reason why, meaning there may be lots of reasons why people color their hair. Who knows what the exact reason is, and therefore you want to make sure, by the virtue of the experts, in fact, she has never colored her hair, because maybe she went away for a while, you didn't know. And besides what she says, the rabbi and his wife had spoken about a tzviut ayin that they had never seen her before. And tzviut ayin goes beyond hair coloring. That's what Rav Moshe Feinstein is going to mention to us. And this is a broad question of tzviut, of the nature of tzviut ayin halacha. He says, you don't have to worry about hair coloring. How do I know that? Because the Gemara in Chulin Daf Tzadi Vav says that if witnesses come into court and say, so-and-so who has this characteristic, they pick some characteristic that's very rare. You know, we saw a guy who has birthmark in the shape of Poland, I don't know, or the shape of California, on his forehead, right? And we saw him murder somebody. We don't know his name, but that's who it is. And we find a guy who has that exact birthmark, exactly the shape of the California. So, by the way, extra points for anybody who can email me at jrothst@gmail.com to tell me where the birthmark in the shape of California reference comes from. Just a little trivia question for you there, right here in the middle. I can't say there's any sweepstakes involved. There's no prizes, but you'll have my greater respect, I suppose, if you email me the answer to that question. So, they say so-and-so murdered somebody. They don't say so-and-so. They say a person with this symbol. We don't do anything about that, because that is not in halacha a valid form of testing. But they say, we saw the guy. This is the guy. And that's Tviyut Ayin Katlinan Le. So you see that Tviyut Ayin, this idea of recognition, goes beyond any particular siman. So the point is, even if you could show me that this girl had at some point, had perhaps at some point dyed her hair red, the testimony of the rabbi and his wife, they'd never seen her before, is independent of that, of Moshe Feinstein is claiming, because that's what Tviyut Ayin is. He says, well, that might not be a full proof, because it could be. This is not a topic he's going to round out for us here, but becomes an interesting question. It could be to say that somebody is so-and-so, so then Tviyut Ayin doesn't have to worry about whether the guy colored his hair or not, because you're going to verify, yes, I know it's so-and-so, that isn't a problem with the hair covering. But if you're going to say that this person is not somebody that I once knew with a Tviyut Ayin, maybe you could say that no, that hair coloring is enough that it will confuse people and say, oh, I never met this person before, even though it's really just the difference in hair color. So that's a clinical for police and, you know, in non-Jewish context as well, as and people who are, let's say, on the run for some reason, they want to change their look enough that people won't recognize them. What do they need to do? So does hair coloring work fully or not fully or partially? So that's all going on under the surface here. But Moshe Feinstein's saying that he thinks that it helps that the husband, that the Rav and his wife who did the wedding, the rabbi who did the wedding and his wife, claim they've never met her before with a Tviyut Ayin. He thinks that that's by and large independent of hair color. On the other hand, though, he said, and I'm sorry, not on the other hand, he says that question he just raised, that maybe there's a difference between verifying that somebody is somebody or verifying that it's not the person you met before, maybe that's not an important distinction, because the Gemara in Yevamot, when it's talking about finding a person who has passed away, the Gemara says, Ein me'idin, you can't give testimony that you found the missing person, and this is his or her, but usually in the Gemara the question is his, because you're worried about the wife being able to marry somebody else. You don't give testimony that it's this person, Ella al partsuf panim, the form of the face, im chotam vegam padachat. You need to have the nose and the forehead still there. So that Gemara seems to be taking for granted that Tviyut Ayin, recognition, is not good enough to say that it's Ploni, that it's so-and-so. So it seems to be that unless you have some deep reason you need to use Tviyut Ayin, no, it is true that Tviyut Ayin does work in some ways in those halachot, the halachot of identifying corpses, but the Gemara seems to be differentiating between when you have clear evidence somebody is somebody, and that will be if their face is still there with the nose and the forehead. That's going to be a different level of recognition, and you won't go down to Tviyut Ayin unless you have to, because it's not there. And it sounds like as soon as you don't have the partsuf panim, the form of the face, with the nose and the petachat and the forehead, I'm pretty sure petachat is a forehead. It is a forehead. So unless you have that, you can't be, that's the what's going to happen next is the second level recognition, and that'll be what's called a Tviyut Ayin. So then it might be true, in fact, that if you do something consciously, try to change the look enough, the Tviyut Ayin won't work, then maybe you have to worry about that. And yeah, that somebody will say, oh, that's not so-and-so, even though it is, or they'll say, that is so-and-so, even though it's not. But since we, in fact, do allow for Tviyut Ayin in that context, it seems like, no, Tviyut Ayin does work. So, in other words, when it says you don't give Eidos, that's one thing. Once you get down from Eidos, you do have Tviyut Ayin, and Tviyut Ayin does work in cases of Aguna and people who passed away. And therefore, it should work here as well. And we should be able to say that this is support for her claim that she never got married. Now, the problem is, you could say this Rav is really only an Eidah, but he's one witness. And the wife, his wife, for all that she's a perfectly fine woman, doesn't count as witnesses in halakhic context. Nonetheless, because since since the husband, or the putative husband, the young man, had said, this is the rabbi who made the Kiddushin, and this rabbi is saying, no, I didn't, that strengthens his thing, because we don't need testimony in this situation. We need, the putative husband had based his claim on a factual statement about this man, and this man is denying that factual statement, so that ruins or hurts the claim. And Rosh adds, all this, of course, is only because we're looking for more support to be more confident, but the fact is that halakhically, from the moment she said, you never married me, then we halakhically believe her, and at least from her perspective, and she's not required to think of herself as married for him. What about the rabbi in Montreal who says that she told him he's her husband? So, first of all, he's an Eid Echad, but he's an Eid Echad that she is contradicting because she's saying he never was my husband. So when you have an Eid Echad, a one witness, on these kinds of situations, so one witness doesn't work for very much, and if she's denying what the witness said, so that doesn't count for anything in our situation. But more than that, even if it were to be true that, even if we concede that she said to him what she said, like what he claims she said, that she said to him, he is my husband. She didn't say he married me kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. So, because when people refer to a husband, they don't necessarily mean with kiddushin, right? Because let's say you have a civil marriage. Let's say for whatever reason you have a civil marriage, those people will talk about each other as husband and wife, even though halachically they are likely not husband and wife. That is actually a matter of debate between Moshe Feinstein, Zeichus Elivracha, and Yosef Elio Henkin, Zeichus Elivracha. Moshe Feinstein held, and this is an important thing for Gittin purposes and for Mamzerus purposes, for whether who counts as a Mamzer, as a halachically illegitimate child or not, and therefore can't marry other Jews, and the whole complicated, terrible situations that are created if Jewish women marry somebody halachically, then they don't get divorced halachically, then they marry somebody again, somebody else, and have a child. It doesn't matter if the second marriage is halachic or not, it can't be halachic if she didn't have a get, and therefore any children from that second marriage will be mamzerim, and it creates terrible problems. So one of the challenges was, what happens if people have civil marriages? There are halachic reasons to think that civil marriages create what are also considered halachic marriages. The Moshe Feinstein held that they do not, and that was a very important leniency in terms of astringency aspects as well, but it's a leniency in terms of any children that come out of a second marriage. So here, the point that he's making is that a civil marriage, people will refer to as a husband and a wife, even though it's not true. And it may be that she thinks to herself, she's 15, maybe that she thinks to herself that the city hall in Toronto has it under her name that she married so-and-so, even though it was a lie, even though he brought a different woman to her. And it might be that she thinks that you know, when they went to the rabbi and they told the rabbi her name, even if she wasn't the one who was there, she might have gotten into her head that they're married, says Rav Moshe Feinstein. So the fact that she refers to her as her husband doesn't tell us there was actually a kiddushin, a real halachic marriage, and that's important for us to know. And I'm skipping a little bit, just because he goes back and forth about some of the various shitos about what happens when somebody says something originally, which would make it chaticha de isur. Let's remember that concept. Meaning that one issue is the truth of a matter, and another issue is when somebody says in court, X happened, even if the court doesn't believe that person for whatever reason, either because it's unsupported or because they have evidence the other way, that person having claimed that in court means that that set of facts applies to that person. That person has to live as if that set of facts is true. So here, if she had referred to him as her husband, and that were to mean they got married with a chuppah and kiddushin in the Jewish way, and she kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, if that's what those words meant, then maybe we would have said, whatever the truth was, she has declared it that way, and therefore she has to live as if that declaration is true. There is a Mishnah Melech who says that if a person said something and then changed their mind about it, they claim they didn't mean what they said, or they were lying when they said it before. So one possibility is they have an amatla, they have a valid explanation for what they did. But even if they don't have an amatla, even if they don't have some kind of an explanation for what they did, the Mishnah Melech held that if the witnesses are disproven, if there's evidence to counteract the witnesses to this situation, there too the person will not become a chaticha de isur. They won't have to act according to what they originally said. Sorry, if it was denied by witnesses. Person claims X, doesn't have an excuse for why they claim X, but witnesses come and say that thing X that this person claims is not true. Mishnah Melech held this person does not have to follow their own claim about themselves, even though they ordinarily were. So here too, even if she originally said, he's my husband, even if that were true, and even if she meant, we got married by chuppah and kiddushin, we got married in a Jewish way, and therefore we're Jewishly married, even if she meant that. So ordinarily, if she says that, and if she says it just with no evidence for it, she just says it, we would think that maybe she has to act according to it because she said it. That's called Shavya Nafshe Chaticha de Yisura. She made this relevant and applicable to herself. But Mishnah Melech says, when there are witnesses contradicting her claim, then she doesn't have to. And here we do, because the rabbi who supposedly did the Kiddushin has made it clear that he didn't do the Kiddushin for this man and this woman. And Moshe Feinstein explains that as being that if there are witnesses to contradict the person, it must be, or we can assume, that it's because the person has an amat that has an explanation for why they're saying what they're saying, even though it's not true. And they can't reveal that to us either. So even if they say, I have no explanation for why I did what I did, we have to think that they might have an explanation. They don't feel comfortable revealing yet. And therefore, the witnesses can help us say, no, you don't have to follow what your claim was. And now, especially, she's saying very clearly she never got married in a Jewish way, and the rabbi who supposedly married them says he never did. So there's good reason to think she doesn't have to follow what she said, and she doesn't have to treat herself as married at all. Now here, of course, so most of the things you might have to check with the witnesses to that marriage that occurred in Toronto, not just the rabbi, and that might support it more. But here he says it's also true that you have an open amatla, you have a very clear explanation for why she was saying the things she was saying. She was pregnant, and the whole point of the marriage was to remove or reduce some of the shame from the pregnancy, so she obviously wouldn't have said out loud anything to contradict that she would refer to him as her husband, because she wants to claim that she's married, regardless of what the truth is. She wants to claim that she's married so she doesn't have the embarrassment of being an unwed mother. So that's a good amatla, says Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he says it might even be true that even if she showed the marriage license to and the ketubah and the marriage document that the rabbi had written out for them to her parents and her friends, there too it probably doesn't create a problem for us, because she's doing it because she's embarrassed that she's pregnant, so she's just saying, I got married. And it's odd to get married at 15, or surprising to get married at 15 even back then, but it's a lot better than being an unwed mother and having a baby out of wedlock. One of the places this comes up is, let's say a woman, it used to be that women had special garments they wore when they were nidot, and it was a sign between her and her husband, it was a sign maybe for everybody, or maybe just for the women in the neighborhood, that they would know that she was a nidah. So let's suppose a woman was wearing big day nidot, she wore these things, right, and we don't have to get into the exact details of how that would or wouldn't happen today. She's wearing these things, and then she says, oh, you know what, I was never any die. And it's just, I would not, never, never, but never in the last week or two. And she says, and I wore this for other reasons. So the question, that's the question, where does an amatla work for her or not, in terms of then allowing her to act as if she's not any die. So here too, if we know of a good reason why she would have done it, then that can qualify as an amatla, says Ramosha. We can believe her that she was never married. One more complication is that the rabbi that she consulted with, he's sort of the fly in the ointment here. The rabbi who's the friend of her father's, with whom she consulted, and to whom she said, he's my husband. So Moshe Feinstein is saying now, maybe she said he was her husband because she didn't want to be embarrassed or embarrass her parents. She wanted to make it seem like she got married young, and maybe a quickie marriage, but she's married. So he says, well, after the couple came to me to consult with me, they maybe didn't live together, right? He lives with his parents and she lives with her parents, but sometimes they live together. Kederach HaPrutzim, as Rav Moshe Feinstein says, people who don't have a proper sexual ethic will sometimes do. So, first of all, we don't have any witnesses to that. And he says, a lot of people don't worry about Isur Yichud in our times, unfortunately. So Isur Yichud is when a man and woman are alone together. So this rabbi is saying, I've seen them be alone together many times, which would suggest, I'm pretty sure, they continued having an inappropriate, meaning a sexual relationship, which would sound like he got married, they got married because in halacha, we generally assume that acts of sexual relations are not zinut, or not just promiscuous. The halachic principle of the Gemara is, ein adam oseh b'ilato b'ilat zinut. People don't generally have relations just for non-marriage purposes. Now, that gets complicated in our times when we know that people do have relations for non-marital purposes. So different poskim will handle that different ways. Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't need to get there yet, because he says all we know is that there's yichud, that they were alone together, but nobody saw anything more than that because they were private about it. So yichud alone doesn't do anything. So even if it were to be true factually that they had relations many times afterwards, that would only be, we don't have any witnesses to that. And when it comes to Yichud alone, we don't treat that as evidence they got married. Because after all, the evidence was that they saw the boy come visit her many times at her father's house. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says, but you don't know there was anybody else in the house at the time. I mean, the people didn't go in and investigate the house. They just said, oh, I saw her there, and I knew the parents were away, let's say. The parents were on vacation. He came over to stay. He stayed the whole weekend. So maybe there were other people there all the time. So Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying, you don't have proof of this. This is another example. We've seen other examples of this, but another example of where halacha is also very formalistic, where unless certain conditions are met, it's not considered a halachic reality, even if intuitively we all know that it is, and X or Y or Z is in fact a halachic reality. And then he throws in a piece of this, I'm not sure what he means about this. He says, "V'kama mufkarim ka'ilu," even people who are open like this, who are not chaste, who are promiscuous. But mufkari means, like, I don't know if it's hefker that belongs to nobody. So mufkari means people who are willing to give away their sexuality to anybody who wants it. But this is shekvar ansa. He's already, now ansa usually means that he raped her. I'm not sure if the Moshe Feinstein means, it's not clear from the tshuva. He raped her originally, literally raped her. And therefore, she got pregnant. And then once she was pregnant, she continued a relationship with him, but only because she was already pregnant by him. She thinks they got married in some sense of the word in Toronto. And therefore, she thinks it's her obligation to have relations with him. That might be one way that he means it. He also might mean it as he statutorily raped her because she was 15. She was underage at the time. And everything they did together was statutory rape, possibly. Or you might mean raped her because even if she thought she consented to it by virtue of the fact that that would be statutory rape. Example, let's just go on from there. So this is ansa. And Avar Ali Sur Nida, we have no evidence that she went to mikvah. We think she didn't go to mikvah, and therefore they violated another important isser. And also, he's the kind of guy who just has relations with whoever he has relations with. He doesn't care. He would have a, you know, kashrut al arayot means somebody we suspect would be willing to have relations with whoever came along. And he's not observing anyway. Also, the Rivash already says that there, we no longer apply the principle. It's going to be important, as I said before, for many, many other cases that Moshe Feinstein will confront, and other rabbis will confront, the Rivash, and the Rivash lives a long time ago. The Rivash is in the 14th century, late 13th of early 14th century in Spain. So it's a long time ago. He already said then that that person no longer has a chazaka, has a presumption, that he would never have promiscuous relations. And that means if he would have promiscuous relations, just the fact of seeing a man and a woman have relations with each other doesn't mean that there was an intent to marry, as could easily be true in the 20th century in America as well. The Rambam paskens that way in Siman Chaf Vav. So that would be more reason to say that even if you thought you saw them living together, it doesn't mean they were married, and we don't have to pay attention to it. Another possibility is you could say, well, but there's these rumors that she got married. So, but the rumors, as we've said before, are because she's embarrassed. So she's just embarrassed. She spreads the word that they got married, and maybe they live together a little bit to convince people they got married because they're not operating halakhically, and they don't see that that's worse than this. So they think that if alone we can fool people to think we're married, but fooling people to think you're married is not actually the same thing as being married. The Ramah says, quotes an opinion that a kol like that, but the other way around, Ramah makes it worse for us because he has an opinion that we don't ignore such rumors even if we know they're false. That the fact of a rumor is enough to create certain halakhic realities that we have to respond to. So first of all, a lot of people disagree with that and don't accept that ruling. The Ramah doesn't say it. He says it as a yesh omer, as some say. So they don't disagree with that. They say, no, if the rumor is false, then you don't have to worry about it at all. But now in our situation, it's clear that it's false, as we've proven here. They never got married. But also, this whole idea doesn't have an idea of a kol, a rumor. A kol in halakha, says Ramah Feinstein, has to be something that's chukzak bebeitin. It has to be that a court verified, and also there's no witnesses. A kol usually has to involve witnesses, and therefore, especially since, like he says, she's 15, and in our times nobody gets married when they're 15, so it's clear they were doing all of this because she's embarrassed about being pregnant, and therefore we don't have to pay full attention to all the things that she's saying, and we can just ignore this and say, no, she never got married, and then all the evidence that came out that she was married was part of their attempts to pretend she was married out of the embarrassment of her having had a baby when she wasn't, of her getting pregnant out of wedlock and having a baby out of wedlock. Therefore, Moshe Feinstein says, the truth is, even if she wanted to marry a Kohen later on, you could tell me, maybe she was a Zinta, maybe she had relations with other people, maybe other people were even prohibited to her, maybe that created prohibition for her, maybe we have to like doubt her whole status. He says, no, there's nothing to worry about here, because she ansa, because this man forced himself on her. And again, I'm not sure what he means by that, but that's what he says. So we don't have to, even the fact that she had a relationship with this man doesn't need to lead us to worry that maybe she's had relationships with other men and that have created a psul kahuna for her, an ability to marry a kohen. And Moshe Feinstein thinks we don't have to worry about it at all. So in the case of a 15-year-old girl who seems to have gotten married in some senses but seems not to have gotten married in other senses, Moshe Feinstein finds a way to tell the rabbis of Montreal, they don't have to worry about this woman at all. She's completely unmarried. She has a child, I think, but she's completely unmarried. And she can marry whoever she wants in the future without this constituting any sort of a problem or a blemish on her record. That's a response of the day for the 20th day of Adar Sheni. My name is Gideon Rothstein. Thank you, Theodore. Thank you, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hochhauser. Have a great day.